At any point during sex with this student or after sex with this student, did you say, in the eyes of the law, I just committed rape?
No, I didn't say that.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. She was young, blonde, and beautiful, a teacher who looked more like a pop star than someone that should be standing at the front of a classroom. But Deborah LaFave wasn't making headlines for her looks. Indeed, she was making them for a crime that shocked the nation. LaFave wasn't just a teacher, she was a predator, grooming and exploiting a 14-year-old boy in her care. And here's what made the case so explosive. Whilst most offenders rightly face decades behind bars, Deborah's punishment sparked outrage because so many people believe she got away with it. And was it her appearance? Was it her gender? Or was this just another example of a justice system riddled with double standards? Because this isn't just a story of scandal. It's a story that forces us to ask, who really gets protected when crimes like this are committed? This is going to be one of those that I promise you will leave you conflicted, as it has me. Let's talk about the perpetrator. Let's talk about Deborah LaFave. So she was born as Deborah Jean Beasley on August 28, 1980. She was born in Riverview, a very nice area in Florida. And of course, Florida, synonymous with sunshine. And when she was growing up, she had a regular family. She had a really great relationship with her sister, Angie. And she really loved her time with her sister. In fact, she saw her sister as a mentor, as much as she was a sibling and a friend. And it seems that LaFave, from the very early days of her childhood, had this dream, and the dream was she was gonna become a teacher. She used to play with the toys, and she used to make out that she would be the teacher at the head of the class, and it was something that she wanted to create a reality of. And that stays with her through her childhood, and she does well at school. So she goes on to excel through East Bay High School. That was until her junior year in 1996. She then moved to Bloomingdale High School. And in 1998, she graduated there. And obviously that means there was some kind of fracture in her education, but essentially she still attains academically very, very effectively. Now, after she finishes school, she goes to the University of South Florida. This is where she earns a degree in English. So she's an academic button, so to speak. But things weren't always easy for her. So during her teenage years, she allegedly experienced rape, early sexual exposure, which can also have impact as you grow older regarding relationships. She also struggled in her childhood with depression. And she also went through periods of suicidal ideation, and she dealt with eating disorders. She was also somebody who genuinely felt that she wasn't good enough when it came down to her body. And certainly these were all things that culminate in understanding there was some mental distress when she was growing up. Now, reportedly, she dated Nick Carter from the Backstreet Boys. That's going to be going through your head all day. Backstreet's back. All right, but basically they meet at school. They were both students at East Bay High School. So it's in 1995 to 1996. She was between 15 and 16 years of age at that point. So he was her first ever boyfriend. And they dated for around a year and a half. Now at this time, teenage Deborah LaFave is basically desperate to be rich and famous herself. And Nick's manager, he was actually in the process of working with her and having her learn a song that he was considering having her record. Because she looks amazing, doesn't she? She could be a front singer of a band or a solo artist. She looks that good. Now, Carter claimed that the reason that they split up was she'd actually cheated on him with a classmate. And understandably, that betrayal meant that Nick's manager stopped contacting her. So to some degree, that's the end of that potential singing career. And Nick later said that his publicist actually advised him to keep the fact quiet that he'd even lost his virginity to her when the case had broken in the news. So this was something that even when Nick was famous, people were saying, well, you don't want to be associated with this in your past, because this woman has been accused and indeed finally found guilty of something absolutely disgraceful. Now, like I said, during the relationship with Nick Carter, she ends up having a relationship with a female classmate. And one could look at her past and say, considering she suggested that she was raped
when she was younger, this could be a reaction to feeling that men were unsafe. I'm not saying that people engage in lesbian relationships or bisexual relationships all the time because of that, but certainly the research seems to evidence that women often seek relationships with women, yes, because of attraction, but also because they feel a level of safety around those women. So I'm not saying that's absolutely the psychological reason why she ends up cheating on Nick with a woman. I'm saying that there is certainly a potential that that trauma leads her to feel that maybe exploring a relationship with a female would be something that she'd be engaging in to try to deal with some of the trauma that she'd experienced around men. Now, her mum finds out, and her mum is not happy. She's not happy that she's engaged in a same-sex relationship. And this is why that break in her education occurs when she leaves one school to go to another. Her parents basically withdrew her from East Bay High. This is again when she's around 15 to 16 years of age. Apparently, it's because her mother disapproved of her romantic involvement with the girl that was a classmate, and she basically wanted to cut ties. Now, that in itself is very distressing. If you're a young person and you end up in a situation with a girl or a boy and your parent finds out and they're so annoyed with those choices or ashamed of those choices, they literally remove you from your peer group, from your friendship network, from everything you've known before, because that tells you a really powerful message. It says your choices are bad and you should feel a level of shame over them. Now, add to that the mix that we have here with LaFave saying that she went through trauma and abuse as a young person, and that's going to be a heady mix walking forward where sex is concerned, very much mingled and mixed with shame and fear. And that certainly can have an impact in some of the choices that we make down the line. By the way, this is not going to excuse her behavior whatsoever when we're talking about her being with a young person, but I'm just highlighting how trauma can certainly play into sexual relationships. Now, like I said, Deborah LaFave alleges that she was raped by a classmate. This was when she was in eighth grade, so she'd have been around 13 to 14 years of age at that point. And she said that those assaults, they weren't a one-off. They've been going on for an extended period of time. And there's this one occasion where a teacher basically catches Deborah LaFave and this classmate who's abusing her in a bathroom at the school. Now, she said that that actual engagement was non-consensual, but the teacher, understandably, I can completely comprehend why they will have thought this. They thought that the two of them were just fooling around and basically says, look, I'm not going to report you. Obviously suggests don't do this again, but she isn't going to take it any further. So they were not aware at that moment in time that LaFave was not in a consensual situation. And when she was interviewed about this, because understandably, this has come up in interviews when they've asked her about the abuse that she suffered, why didn't you tell the teacher this was happening to you? And she said, you know, when somebody has that kind of control over you, especially at 13, I didn't tell anybody. She also described the rapes as violent. So that's a very pivotal period of time when you're 13 years of age, particularly as a young girl, and to go through that kind of aggressive, violent, non-consensual situation, that is obviously going to cause fractures within your psyche and certainly going to impact on your mental health enormously. It's also going to make you realize that having sex at a time when you are certainly not ready, and in this case, not willing, is going to have huge ramifications for you as a human being. So the last thing you should want to do with that in mind is ever carry out any kind of harm to a young person sexually. Because you're going to be the person who absolutely is in the driving seat of understanding how awful that is. Just keep that in mind when we talk about this case. Now, apparently during her childhood years, she did have issues. So she had obsessive behaviours, she had phobias. As I said, she went through an eating disorder and she actually tried to take a life at least on two occasions. One was during an overdose and another was through cutting her wrist. So they are serious attempts at life. And clearly that speaks to a deep unhappiness that was within her at that moment in time. But in spite of the fact that all this is going on, like I said, she's bright, she's clever, she's academic. So she ends up going to the University of South Florida. And even when she's struggling with her mental health there, in fact, one of her friends says, look, you need to see a psychiatrist. And indeed, she does go and see a psychiatrist and they do diagnose her with depression. It will turn out to be the wrong diagnosis But nonetheless, it's clear there are things going on for her on a mental health level. They actually prescribe her Zoloft. And initially she said, that really helped me. I felt like I was not crying anymore. I didn't feel as emotional anymore. But after a relatively short period of time, it just stopped working effectively. And some people believe that mental health drugs are effective. Some people believe they aren't. Some people think they're a placebo effect, but it's irrelevant. What matters is the individual subjective experience. And certainly for her, the lift is immediate and sustained for a period of time. But then she drops back to where she is and those drugs don't feel like they're working effectively. And that is down to the fact that it is an incorrect diagnosis, which I'll come to later on. Then she goes through a really horrific family tragedy, and it is just awful. Her older sister, Angela Beasley, Angie, who was 5 months pregnant, she's killed. She's killed in April 2001 by a drunk driver. The offender was actually an army officer. He later received a 30-year sentence, so it was taken incredibly seriously that he killed this pregnant woman. And you can just imagine, can't you? For somebody like Lefebvre, who's unbelievably connected to his sister, sees her as a mentor, a guide, somebody who offers a great soothing in her life, from what I can understand, is suddenly ripped away from her. And not just ripped away from her as an individual, but actually taking her unborn niece or nephew with her. That is obviously going to be deeply traumatic and life-changing on so many levels. Now, despite this utterly devastating trauma, she does still manage to graduate with an English degree. And it's also during her time at university that she starts dating her future husband, Owen Lefebvre. Now, they did meet in high school. They were actually both dating other people at the time. They were attracted to each other, but they didn't take it any further. So it wasn't until she was doing her degree that they reconnected and they did begin dating seriously. So she earns that degree around 2002. At this point, she secures successfully a position as an English teacher, specialist with reading at Angelo L. Greco Middle School in Temple Terrace, Florida. So it's going really well. Now, a year into that teaching position, Owen and Lefebvre are married. That's in July 2003. So she really is thriving. She's got her husband, she's got her career, everyone loves her. She was apparently very, very popular. I mean, not just for her looks, but just for her attitude and her general demeanor. And one of the things that I'd say about her looks is it's clear from very early on in her life, she was aware that she was attractive. It's clear that other people related to that. She was given modeling options. She was in various magazines, kind of quite glamour orientated, less catwalk orientated. So this is somebody whose looks have worked for her during her childhood, teenagehood, and into her early 20s. But what we can also say is bear in mind, she has been sexualized early on through the abuse, through the rape, and then through being placed in magazines because of her body and so on and so forth. And yet she has all of these conflicts within her. She has a suicidal ideation, the attempt, she's got the mental health issues. So it feels like on the outside, everything looks great, but on the inside, things often capsize and feel incredibly challenging for her. Now, understandably, when she's married to Owen, she takes his last name, so she becomes Deborah Lefebvre. And she does at this point seem, shall we say, on a path towards a promising future, a promising personal and professional life, but it's not plain sailing. I mean, no relationship is ever plain sailing. Even in the honeymoon period, we can go through problems, and there are issues in her marriage. In fact, her ex-husband, Owen, gave interviews and said that Deborah was initially a good wife. She's very loving, but he noticed really early on in the relationship she had quite severe mood swings and she went through some emotional struggles. He said, as she had noted before, she was treated for depression, she was treated for an eating disorder, so it validates what she talks about regarding her mental health. But he did downplay the severity in the interviews that I've heard, and part of that will probably be the anger and resentment that he feels to some degree about her actions. Part of it will be that he probably didn't understand the severity of it, because we don't when we're not actually the person going through it. So even though he downplays it, it doesn't mean that it wasn't serious as far as she was concerned. And Deborah later says in interviews herself that genuinely, her emotional state during her marriage meant that she did make some really poor judgments. She did get involved in risky behavior. Bear in mind, at this point, Lefebvre is doing really well. She's married, she's got a dream career, and she is literally thriving professionally. She'd also, at the school she taught at, gained a really excellent reputation among the students because she was considered really kind-hearted, genuinely empathic. But then things begin to spiral both professionally, personally, and with respect indeed, criminally. And this begins when she innocently agrees to assist the football coach during a school tag football game. This is when she comes into contact with her 14-year-old victim. Now, she wasn't actually teaching him at the time. He wasn't her student. But during that game, he notices her, as his friend does as well, and they kind of go over and they start a conversation with LaFave, and this seems to be how they initially connected. Now, it is perfectly normal for young boys who see attractive teachers to feel that they might develop a crush on them. We see that constantly, completely typical. And the deal is, kids can have as many crushes as they want on adults because the adult knows boundaries. The adult knows what is appropriate and inappropriate. So it should not be in any way, shape or form dangerous for a teenager to develop a crush on an adult teacher because the adult teacher knows how to make it clear nothing would ever happen and to close those things down. It's as simple as that. And that's exactly what should have happened in this case. But it isn't going to. Because the next time she meets this victim, it's in May 2004. This is basically during the final week of school. It's grad night. And the graduating class, like a lot of classes do, have trips out. So they end up going to SeaWorld in Orlando and she ends up chaperoning that trip. So she's there as well with the young people. Now it seems this is a critical juncture. This is when she starts to view this 14-year-old boy in a really inappropriate manner. Now, what's even more disturbing is on that actual trip, her husband Owen was there as well. But bear in mind, he's not gonna for one second suspect his new wife of being attracted to a kid. Why would he? He's married an adult. He believes that that adult that he's married is attracted to him. He's not going to be concerned about a 14-year-old young man, a child, essentially. Also, it's interesting that around this time, he starts to suspect his wife of actually having an affair. But he thinks that she's having an affair with somebody who is an adult age, i.e. a colleague at school. So he's obviously suspicious of her and can sniff out that something is going on. And very often we see this psychologically in relationships. Very often partners will know that the person they are with is having some kind of affair because they change the way they act. They get giddy, they lose weight sometimes, they start dressing differently, they seem energized and excited. And on the whole, all those things would usually bode well, but not when you are used to that person seeming very different. And all of a sudden they become chipper and excited and nothing's wrong with the world when last week everything was. And that really does make people suspicious who are in relationships because they think, what has changed because it isn't me? And that's often the first insight that people will have that their partner is cheating on them. Now, after this trip, Deborah LaFave basically goes out of her way to get as much time with this 14-year-old as possible. So she puts him on detention to spend time with him. She actually invites his friends to go as well. So she's kind of seeing herself to some degree as a peer of these young people as opposed to an educator. And on one occasion, she basically kisses him and then it kind of escalates and she actually has oral sex with him. So we've now gone past any point of seeing her in a professional context. She's now in a predatory context and she's taking this to a place where her actions are now criminal. Now, there is actually an account by one of the boy's friends who alleges that Deborah was asked by the victim to flash her breasts at him whilst they're in a classroom. This was outside of lesson time. Now, bear in mind, his friends were also present at that point. So it would be career suicide to do something like that. But LaFave apparently did pull up a shirt to reveal a tiny bit at the bottom of a bra. So she does breach a boundary there as well, because that is completely a red rag to a bull. If you've got a group of teenagers and you do that, expect that to spread gossip-wise like wildfire. I mean, teenagers are not known for containing confidential realities when there is something as exciting as this teacher's coming on to whoever they're coming on to. It's going to get talked about. So it shows you that she isn't really thinking or computing about the consequential reaction and reality of what she's doing. Now, apparently on that occasion, when he asked her to show the bra, when the friends leave, they get involved intimately yet again. But they haven't had sex at this moment in time. They've had oral sex, but not actual intercourse. Now, on the last day of school, something really weird happens. One of the other students hosts a party. This boy is invited. She ends up going to the party with him. I mean, I'm not saying they actually went together, but the motivation behind her arriving is that he's going to be there. Now, that's really strange. She's the only teacher who turns up. And when people notice them together, one of the things that's strange is that he actually uses terms like girlfriend to describe who she is to other people, which clearly is bizarre. This is his teacher. Again, why would she be okay being around somebody using that language that's incriminating when somebody points a finger at her and says, he's saying you are his girlfriend, but you are his teacher? I mean, again, that exposes her on every level, but she just doesn't seem to be that concerned. In fact, I would say throughout this, the theme runs through that she doesn't see herself, at least during this period of time, as doing anything wrong. She sees herself as an equal, not as an educator, not as a professional, and she doesn't see the relationship that she believes she's building as inappropriate at all. Now, by the end of that party, she'd given the boy her number, and apparently there was even talk about them taking it to the next level so they could have sex together. Now, bear in mind, we're getting to the start of the summer holidays at this point, and she's frequently speaking to him on the phone, and let's be real, from the court records that I found, the relationship between Deborah Lefebvre and her 14-year-old victim lasted just 4 weeks. So it was discovered really, really quickly. So that just demonstrates the escalation in the exploitation of this child and how quickly it happened. And also, how often young people fall prey to this kind of escalation, because they might think they're in charge, but they're not in charge. They're a child. They don't have any understanding of true relationships, of real relationships. They've got very little comparison data. So they are led by the adult. And even if that adult doesn't believe that they are the leader, it doesn't discount that they are effectively the leader, whether they like that or otherwise, no matter how they play it. Now, it turns out that one of the things that she starts to do is to kind of have more romantic conversations with him. She tells him that she's got feelings for him, that she can't get rid of those feelings. And one of the things that she allegedly discusses is the issue she's having with her marriage. Again, you're not going to get very far with a 14-year-old, are you? No disrespect to 14-year-olds out there. I appreciate that you are bright, you are clever, you are knowledgeable in so many ways. Far more knowledgeable, for example, around youth culture than I will ever be nowadays, because I'm 927 years old. But of course you don't have a real in-depth knowledge of core relationships and intimate relationships, nor should you. That's the adventure you're going to go on. So if somebody sits down with you and starts saying, oh, by the way, my marriage is in this situation, in this state, you're not really going to be able to advise them appropriately because you've never been in that situation. That will be something you'll be able to advise people of 15, 20 years down the line. Now, there have been some reports where it suggests that she told her victim that she was turned on by the fact that they were having sexual relations and that it wasn't allowed. Now, this is, with respect, something that she's vehemently denied in an interview. She said she'd never say that. She never said that. She's got no memory of saying that. And it's not the kind of context that she spoke within. And there are phone calls that I'll come onto afterwards between her and the young boy. I would say that she certainly doesn't sound like she's being sexually overt in them, but that doesn't mean that she didn't say that.
You enjoyed the show before.
I did. Did you?
Yeah.
So it's not over? Yeah. My God. Why can't you just say, go? Not yet.
If, of course, she did say that, that would demonstrate that she was fully aware of what she was doing, why she was doing it, why it was wrong, and also an understanding of the predator within her. But like I said, she's denied it in many interviews. Now, as well as what I've just told you, one of the things that she did was she gave the boy a key pendant. Now, it had a butterfly on one side and the word hope on the other. Apparently she gifted it to him because she had one like it for herself and she wanted him to have another one. So it was a symbol of this bond of their relationship. And on one level, if you're a 14-year-old boy, that could seem quite alluring, quite intoxicating. You've got this beautiful adult who's really looking after you on an emotional level by telling you you're amazing, you're fantastic, you're sexually desirable. And then she's giving you nice presents, which is all so lovely. It says hope and it's got a butterfly. But actually, when you break it down to the bare bones. It's just classic grooming behavior, making a child feel special, then giving them things to make them feel like you should not be betrayed, that they should keep quiet about your relationship. This is how children get imprisoned in these relationships, because they become so loyal to the person that they're having a sexual relationship with, even though they don't realize they've been coerced into it, even though they don't realize they've been groomed into it, that it's so confusing that they often remain silent. That's grooming, end of. Now, it appears, from what I can find out, that the sexual acts commenced around June the 3rd, 2004. Now, he talks to the authorities about the fact that she and he had sex on multiple occasions, and it was over a few days. It included places like the bedroom of a Riverview condominium, also in her portable classroom at school, which is just beyond the pale, isn't it? I mean, any sex with a child is disgraceful, despicable, illegal, immoral, unethical. Goes without saying. But there is just something about taking him to your actual home, having sex with him in your marital bed, having sex with him in a classroom that's meant to be safe for him, where he gets educated, where he believes that people want the best for him. That's beyond seedy and beyond breaching boundaries. And also, multiple times they had sex in the backseat of a car. That was a silver 2002 Isuzu Rodeo. And in fact, after their very first sexual encounter, she apparently drove her victim to visit his cousin in Ocala. That's 100 miles out from their hometown. This actually happened on a couple of occasions. Now, the first time he drove up with her, they arrive at his cousin's to pick his cousin up. She then basically hands the cousin her car keys, then gets into the back of the car with the victim and has sex with him in front of the cousin. Now again, that's abusive, not just for the young man that she's having sex with. It's abusive for the witness. He's a child. What is she doing? Feeling that it's appropriate to have sex in front of another minor. But she does that. She has no issue with doing that. And that, again, shows poor consequential thinking, really low impulse control, and just a denial entirely of reality. And some people will say, well, doesn't that just show emotional instability that she'd do those things? Well, on one hand, yes, it does. It also shows an absolute betrayal on every level of who she's meant to be in this child's life. And also, it shows that she doesn't feel that what she's doing is wrong. And that's exactly how predators feel towards their prey. That's how paedophiles feel when they're putting a child in a situation where that child is engaging in sexual acts with the paedophile. The idea that predatory paedophiles are these aggressors who are violent, who are hiding on street corners to steal children off the streets and do horrible things to them, that isn't reality. These individuals are people who are liked by the child, who feel safe with the child as far as the kid's concerned. They believe that that person is a good person in their life. They're the individuals that they might go to talk about their problems. They build alliances and allegiances with these children because the children then feel a level of commitment to them and a level of desire sometimes, because they're kids. They still go through all these feelings that we all have sexually about certain people in our worlds. The thing is that then that predator uses all of that against the child and makes the child feel to some degree like they're actually in a relationship with them, which again is massively confusing. That's the playbook of a predator. And it comes down to the fact that they genuinely don't think they did anything wrong, because in their mind, it feels entirely natural to have sexual relationships with children. And that's why many of these predators can never actually heal, because they have a particular preference regarding the age of the individuals that they are sexually interested in. Now, on the second occasion that she actually takes him to see his cousin, they end up going shopping. This is with the cousin and the victim. She even buys her husband a gift on that trip. She then takes the boys for milkshake. And during this particular trip is really where it starts to unravel, because a friend of the cousin's mother sees the boys in a parking lot, in a car, with this older woman. She noticed that she was apparently provocatively dressed, and she thinks this isn't okay. There is something weird going on. So that particular woman calls the cousin's mum, and the cousin's mum asks her son, says, what's going on in this relationship? Now, this boy is like, nothing, Mum. I don't know what you're talking about. What relationship? There's nothing to see here. So he kind of really stands by his friend. He doesn't want his cousin to be in trouble. He doesn't want anybody to find out. And essentially, he just keeps stum about the fact that he knows that actually his cousin is in a relationship with his teacher. So he just doesn't tell his mum anything. But this woman is like, I am not going to let this slide. She might know her son, but she'll probably also know that he probably doesn't want to get his cousin into trouble. So she thinks, I'm just going to give my sister a call. I'm going to call her. I'm going to give her the information. She can then take that further if she wants to. So basically, she gets on the phone, trusts her instincts, and tells the boy's mother exactly what has been seen by this friend of hers. Understandably, the mother in this case is really concerned. She's thinking to herself, what the hell is going on if he's with this older woman in the car? And so the minute he gets in, she confronts him directly and basically asks him to explain exactly what's going on. And he resists. He doesn't want to tell her because, of course, like I said, he probably knows he's going to get into trouble potentially for having an intimate relationship with an older woman. He won't be thinking, my mum's going to understand because I'm a victim. He's going to be thinking to himself, oh, gee, I'm going to be in super hot water when my mum finds out that I've been intimately involved with a female. That's going to be his major thinking. Secondly, he's not going to want to betray the person that he thinks he's having some kind of relationship with. Bear in mind, he's getting a lot of positivity. His friends are talking about how hot she is. There's a lot of leverage for him in his social network because of this relationship. So that's confusing for him as well. And of course, most importantly, at this point, he won't even see himself as a victim. He'll probably see himself as an equal in this relationship. He doesn't know how he's been groomed. He doesn't understand how he's being coerced. And he doesn't want to betray her. So he doesn't open up. And of course, you can add to that the psychological shame of having to have that conversation with your mum anyway. Who wants to talk to their mum on the whole about the fact that they had some kind of sexual liaison with anyone, full stop? But she isn't giving up. She's really persistent. And she doesn't believe what he's saying, basically. So in the end, he does admit the truth. He says that he's been spending time with his teacher in, shall we say, not the educational ways that any mother would wish to have where their son is concerned. So he talks about the fact that she's been highly inappropriate with him, and his mother is absolutely devastated by this. Of course she is. This is her baby boy. Now, ironically, Lefebvre finds out that they have been spotted. And what she does is bizarre. She actually calls the victim's mum to basically ask her to go easy on her son. She has, at this point, no idea whatsoever just how serious her actions have been. She's acting more like a peer than a predator, and she's certainly demonstrating a lack of any acknowledgement of the criminal activities that she's been involved in. Now, at this point, you can imagine that the mother is just absolutely reeling, and she has no alternative. She loves her child. She knows what's happening is immoral and wrong, and it's illegal, so she goes to the authorities. Now, bear in mind, at this point, Lefebvre is still just blindly thinking it's all going to be okay. She's got no idea whatsoever that this mother is in contact with the police and that she is actually going to be caught through a very well-planned sting operation. So detectives in Hillsborough County, first of all, before they create this sting, they validate whether what this 14-year-old boy is talking about is true. Because understandably, there are children who have fantasies. There are children who make things up about people that they're having relationships with. I'm not for one minute saying it's a regular occurrence. I'm saying it does happen. It can happen. It has happened. So before the police spend money, time, and also just the energy on creating a sting to try to catch this predator, they need to make sure that they can validate that it seems to be based in truth, what's being said. So they ask him to be very specific about things that only an intimate partner could possibly know about Lefebvre. And guess what? He does. He gives a very, very graphic detail about her body and immediately know that he's telling the truth. And they also discover during this conversation that it's not as if he's the only person who has seen their relationship play out, because lots of his friends have witnessed the interactions between him and Lefebvre, and they confirm exactly what he's been describing. They then ask him about the sexual relationship that's gone on? And he says, yes, we have had sex. We've had sex on multiple occasions. So at this point, the police want to get her bang to rights, dead to rights. They want to make sure that if they are going to bring her in, they have got her, and that the only way she's going to get anywhere is to plead guilty and accept the fact that she's going down. That's the main thinking that these officers have when they're creating this sting. They want to gain a confession. They don't want to have to bring her in for questioning. They just want to get her to say exactly what's happened, or at least to intonate what's happened so that they can actually bring her in and say, look, we already know. Just admit it. So the officers decide that the best way forward is to record conversations over the phone between Deborah Lefebvre and the boy. Now, they coach him, tell him what to say. They encourage him to bring up specifics about the relationship and the conversation because they need to nail it down. And on those recordings, it's very clear that she is acknowledging the inappropriate relationship. She's not denying it. It's clear there isn't intimacy between them. So now they have what they need to nail this case down. Now, they want to bring her in. They want to arrest her. And they decide the best place to do this is at an arranged meeting between her and a victim. So they get him to arrange a meeting with her. This is in June 2004. And it's basically on the pretense that his mum's out for the entire day. She's apparently at a sales meeting. That's the ruse. And he wants her to therefore go around and meet him. Now, in that call, she's actually asking him, are you absolutely sure that your mum won't be present? Now, in itself, that's highly incriminating, because if you don't think you're doing anything wrong, if you don't believe that there is a problem in this relationship, you're seeing yourself as a peer, not as a professional involved in this child's life. Why are you that bothered if the mother's there anyway? So the fact that she knows it's incriminating shows that she knows it's 100% damning and wrong. She actually asks him to pinky promise, which is very childlike in form, but bear in mind she's relating to him at that point. As a 14-year-old, I would imagine, she knows exactly what 14-year-olds understand. And so pinky promise, it's very childish and immature. It's actually quite manipulative as well.
Pinky promise.
Now, understandably, the moment she gets there, she's arrested and she's apparently shocked at that point. She just thinks, maybe I've jumped a red light. She was still completely in the dark as to the reason why she was being arrested, which again, just goes to show that she was not thinking about her actions, or at least thinking that those actions were not going to lead to anything negative, because as far as she is concerned, why would he betray her? Now, bear in mind, because the offences took place in two separate counties, it means that two separate sets of charges get filed against her. So one set of charges is in Hillsborough County. That's where her school and also her condo were located. And the second set is in Marion County. Bear in mind, that's where part of the conduct occurred during a trip to Ocala when they go to visit his cousin. So that means that she ends up facing multiple felony counts of lewd and lascivious battery. And then within weeks of the arrest, the district, understandably, they suspend Lefebvre, and they suspend her without pay because, understandably, they have somebody who is now looking to be potentially guilty of the most heinous abuse that can be imagined when you are a teacher. They can't possibly have her going into school and teaching, can they? Now, we get to November 2004. It seems at this point her defence basically spoke out and the press got hold of it regarding the fact they were considering an insanity defence. And the reason they're going to try at this point to go for an insanity defence is they are citing her bipolar disorder and also her long-standing emotional instability. Now, bear in mind, we know that she had been diagnosed with depression by a psychiatrist when she was at university, but that seems to be an incorrect diagnosis. She has bipolar disorder that would once have been referred to as manic depression. So depression used to play into it as an actual classification title, whereas now it's called bipolar disorder. It's characterized by people who go through periods of high mania and people who go through deep crashing depression. Sometimes they can be very fast in happening, kind of cyclical, and often it can be just short periods and short bursts, but it can be incredibly challenging to deal with bipolar disorder. And certainly the medication path, if you choose to have the medication path, is different to the one that she's been on for her depression. Now, we all know the insanity defense bar is a high one. But what they're basically saying is these issues psychologically along with the past trauma that she's had in her own life, they are things they're going to use that would be raised at the trial to underpin why her actions were so diabolical. And with respect to the defense team, they did go ahead and they got psychiatric evaluations, and those evaluations were all about arguing that she had impaired judgment and that she had impulsivity as part of her actual condition. They also would have talked about the fact that with bipolar, sometimes there's hypersexuality. So hypersexuality is where an individual might act in a more impulsive or rash manner sexually. They may not be thinking about the risks they're placing themselves in, and at times that can lead to some really bad choices. Many people with bipolar don't do that, but it does seem to be a part of certain individuals' experience who are given this diagnosis. And another thing that the psychiatrists who actually discussed these issues about who she was and what was going on for her and why she might have acted in this way was they felt prison wouldn't be an appropriate setting for treatment. And instead, they felt that probation with really strict conditions would be more suitable. But then, of course, if you're a defense expert, you're going to do that because you're going to want your client, in this case, your client is the lawyers representing Lefebvre, to be satisfied with using you, helping their client in this situation. But despite that early speculation about the insanity plea, she never actually did plead insanity. And she wouldn't have got away with it anyway, let's be clear. It's a really high bar. There is no way they would have said, oh yeah, she was out of her mind when she was doing this. You know, she was buying presents for her husband. She was walking around in a completely normal way. She wasn't in any psychotic slide. So it would have been impossible for them. But nonetheless, putting that out there kind of lets people know, oh, things were going on in her mind and in her life, and things weren't necessarily that easy for her. And I guess it makes people feel maybe less angry with her actions, at least some people, and that can be a clever ploy when it comes down to the defense regarding getting the community to have a different opinion of their client. Now, what actually happens is that in Hillsborough County, this is where the first set of charges were filed, the prosecutors end up with a pretty agonizing decision to make. So of course, they want justice. There is a 14-year-old boy, very beginning of his life, who they want to get justice for. But they also want to shield him from what can only be described as an ordeal when it comes down to testifying in open court. If you just put yourself in the position, you've got this 14-year-old kid who is going to basically be forced to take the stand, forced to recount intimate details, literally in front of a courtroom of strangers, possibly in front of the media. And that is something that's going to be very challenging for this kid and also for his wider family. So the prosecutors decide that maybe there is a deal to be cut. And bear in mind, they probably took into consideration those psychiatrist reports regarding her instability and regarding some of the circumstantial evidence that suggests that she was having problems just with her mental state. Not that she was insane, but there are these concerns. And like I said, the idea of this 14-year-old probably being cross-examined by the defense, these are all things that they weigh up. So they offer a plea deal. So she agrees essentially to plead guilty to two counts of lewd and lascivious battery. The state accept that plea deal. So then we get to November 2005. This is when Judge Wayne Timmerman passes sentence and he gives her 3 years house arrest and 7 years of probation. I kid you not. Just let that sink in. 3 years of house arrest and 7 years of probation for raping a minor. Let's just say it as it is, for raping a minor. Now, don't get me wrong, this has been a really deeply controversial decision, but nonetheless, went ahead. Don't get me wrong, it guaranteed a conviction, it protected the boy from testifying, so it kind of met the bar it was trying to meet, but it falls massively short of expectation. But when you think about this case, I'm talking about the rape of a minor, and we're saying 3 years house arrest? 7 years probation? And by the way, the story doesn't end there, of course, because we've got the second set of charges that have been filed in Marion County. They are for the acts that occurred within its jurisdiction. Now, again, at this point, Lefebvre's lawyers, well, they're at the point where they're like, right, we've got this sorted here. Let's push for exactly the same probation-only deal. But This time, Judge Hale Stansel refused. He said, listen, if I allow such leniency, it's going to absolutely erode public confidence in the justice system. So in the end, it means that a trial date was set for April 2006. And then this is where another dramatic turn occurs, because court TV applies to televise the proceedings. And you know why? Because be real, these are the kind of cases that hit the headlines and everyone wants to watch. She's looks like she should be on the front of a magazine. She's accused of raping a child. You bet your bottom dollar they're going to want to be in that courtroom, because people are going to watch in their droves, and that's obviously something that's positive for the TV channel. Now, one of the things that I thought to myself when I was researching this case was, hang on a minute. Why should court TV be allowed in if it's going to cause issues, particularly in this case, for the child involved? Because that's going to be terrifying, right? Why can't it just be a clear, absolutely not, there's no way you are coming in. It will be a problem for the case. So court TV, it's a no from us. Now, I've found out the reason they can't do that is because Florida has some of the most open court laws in the US. Now, a judge can restrict cameras, but only if it can be shown that their presence would cause specific harm or deny someone a fair trial. Now, the thing about court TV is they could just argue, well, we'll only bring in one camera and we'll only have it on a particular position where, for example, you're not going to see anybody whose face doesn't want to be shown actually being shown. In this case, shall we say, the victim, because he's 14 years of age and you'd find that incredibly upsetting. So they can restrict what they do, but they can't stop what they do. And in this case, court TV had applied for access and the default position under Florida law was to grant it. Now, don't get me wrong, the state attorney's office argued that cameras would traumatise the boy, would also harm the case. Amen to that. Clearly it would. But the judge did decide that under Florida's open court rules, court TV still had the right to broadcast. Like I said, they would certainly have anonymised the child, but he would still have been there present with the cameras, and that's deeply traumatic. And also imagine his fears about what if somebody sees, what if somebody finds out, because that could bring a level of shame and humiliation. And also for his future life, he might feel that exposes him in different ways, ways that he wouldn't wish to be exposed. Now, for the victim's parents, this is the worst nightmare. They had initially supported a plea deal precisely in the other state because they didn't want their son's face, his name, or his testimony dragged through the national media. And they genuinely believed that forcing him to testify on live TV would 100% re-traumatise him all over again. So in that first case, the plea had been agreed. In this case, the judge said, no, it's not going to be justice. So he's kind of pushed, we're going to go to trial. And the consequence of that is the family is in a really challenging position. They want to protect their son. So they end up speaking up. They make it clear, look, we do not want any part in this case moving forward. The boy says he's going to refuse to testify. The cousin says, I'm going to refuse to testify. So in the end, the prosecutors did listen. So in March 2006, rather than risk subjecting the boy to a public trial, they did drop the Marion County charges completely. So that left the Hillsborough plea deal in place. So that meant house arrest, probation, no prison time. So let's be clear. Deborah Lefebvre didn't walk free because she pled insanity. She didn't enter that plea deal at all. She walked free because her mental health was used as mitigation, because prosecutors were determined to protect a young boy from further trauma, and because one judge allowed probation where another refused. So it was a case that was shaped not by the defendant's actions, but also by the desperate wish of the family to just keep their son safe from the spotlight. So as I've said, she ends up with just 3 years of house arrest and 7 years of probation. Don't get me wrong, mandatory sex offender registration as well. So under the terms of her probation, she had to be home by 10 p.m. every day. She had to be in her home till 6 a.m. every morning. She couldn't leave Hillsborough County without a judge's permission, and she could not be around mine, and she couldn't be within 1,000 meters of a school. But like I said, she was spared any prison time. And LaFave's attractive physical appearance really did become a focal point about arguments in court regarding whether she should go to prison or otherwise. And John Fitzgibbons, who basically was her attorney, he famously defended her at one point by saying this: to place Debbie into a Florida State women's penitentiary, to place an attractive young woman in that kind of hellhole is like putting a piece of raw meat in with the lions. Sorry? Yes, it's like putting raw meat in with lions. Are you suggesting that female prisoners who are incarcerated are lions? I'm saying yes, they are. You're saying that all of them are, like literally all of them, the ones who are debtors, the ones who've just carried out some misdemeanors that they regret. You're saying they're all liars. I'm saying they are possibly liars. Are you saying that every woman in prison is unattractive? I seem like I sound like I am saying that, but I'm not trying to say that. I'm just saying that this particular individual is so attractive, to throw her in there would be like throwing meat into a pack of lions. It does sound like you're saying that every woman in prison is unattractive and is also a massive predator, which is ironic because we're actually dealing with a woman who is actually a predator. She's the predator in this case, and you're saying that throwing a predator into prison isn't fair. It doesn't seem right. I'm saying that what you've just said makes sense, and I'm glad you weren't there to counter my suggestion. Seriously, how ridiculous. The idea that if you're... Sorry, just come in. Let's have a look at you. Well, I mean, you can't come in here. Sorry, why? I've been sent to prison. No, I'm sorry. We have a spectrum here. We have a spectrum of between 1 and 10. And anyone who looks better than a 7... we can't let you in. Why? Well, you wouldn't believe it, but we've got a pack of lions in here and they'll eat you. They'll literally eat you. So you're going to have to just go and do some light probation or something like that. Go and do some voluntary work, some community service, something like that. We can't let you in. You're far too attractive. Because that's the way it works, isn't it? That's how the system should be. If you're attractive, it must be good. If it looks good, it must be good. If it looks good, it must be good. It's as simple as that. That's the mindset. At the end of the day, she's far too pretty for prison. I kid you not. It would be like putting a piece of raw meat in with the lions. And also the very fact that he refers to putting this attractive young woman in that kind of hellhole, that's a little bit derogatory about the whole entire prison system. It's ludicrous. And yet he actually said that. Obviously, just going to throw it out there. Thought she was dead nice looking, didn't he? Maybe fancied her a little bit. And he was like, oh, my client can't go there. She's far too attractive. They'd just rip her to pieces. Instead, we should let a paedophile just wander the streets and just allow her to understand that she's just been a naughty little girl and we'll just be done with it in that way. That's how it comes across. Now, lastly, as part of a plea deal, she was required to surrender a teaching license. She was banned from ever teaching in Florida again, and rightly so. Now, a statement was also made by the prosecution. They actually cited that an assessment by psychologist Martin Lazaritz found that, quote, the victim would be so severely traumatized by a potential trial that it would take as long as 8 years for him to recover. And I completely understand why the prosecution went ahead and stood by the victim, because that's who counts in this situation. And if you're in a scenario where you're weighing up, will the victim be more badly affected by the trauma of going through court than by healing from what's happened to them in that time period? If you figure out the court's going to do more damage, you can understand why they choose not to go down that route. Also, what some people will say is, well, that young man probably wasn't traumatized by what happened. Now, that is often the myth that people peddle. Who wouldn't want to have sex with that beautiful teacher? Who wouldn't see that as a notch on the bed because they've actually managed to nail a 23-year-old when they're 14? Well, actually, we know that that's not true. We know that young men who end up in these situations at school with teachers often have huge problems trusting anyone again. They feel like they've been betrayed on a whole heap of levels. And the idea that it doesn't damage these young men is just mythical. We know from research it does. There have been many studies where young men who have been groomed by female teachers who thought that they were in a consensual relationship, who enjoyed the sex that they had with the older female, they believed at that time they were not being groomed, they were not being coerced, they were not being abused. Down the line, when they look at the impact it has on their future relationships and the car crash it makes of their lives, they often reflect on the fact that it actually taught them they cannot trust anybody. And that has long-term psychological, physical, social, and educational ramifications for them that can impact and affect the rest of their lives. This idea that just because she was a pretty teacher, just because his mates thought she was hot, that he'll be fine, is absolute BS. And it's so disrespectful to these male victims. And I hear it talked about again and again, as if somebody who's pretty can't possibly be a predator, and that a young man of 14 is somehow complicit in these relationships. In fact, themselves chasing that person, therefore deserving of what happens to them. And like I said, all you need to do is put it into the different position. If it was a man of 23 who was a teacher, sleeping with a 14-year-old girl, stealing their innocence, stealing their naivety, stealing their trust, none of us would have a second in calling him out in the most rageful of ways and expecting a very long sentence for him in prison. Now, after this case made the headlines, one of the things that the public did argue was exactly what I've just said. If she was male, there would have been no question about prison time. But instead, she walked free. She pled guilty to really serious crimes. And like I said, the articles out there that you can find yourselves are all about her being too pretty for prison. And like I said, that particular statement by her attorney, it caused outrage because there are a lot of people like you and I out there who can't quite get our heads around how he would see her as distinct from any other criminal. You're a criminal. It's the biggest equalizer. Your looks have nothing to do with your actions. Now, that ended up being quoted in newspapers, TV talk shows, in fact, late night comedies as well, which is so re-traumatizing for that child. Bear that in mind, you know, it might be funny to actually do this as a skit on a late night comedy show, but it's not funny when that kid hears the joke, because he's part of it. And funnily enough, in the UK, everyone's talking about the two-tier justice system that's playing out here. And with respect, it was a two-tier justice system. Like I said, if it had been a male, he would have gone to prison without a doubt. Certainly in America. I'm not so sure about in the UK these days. I mean, we are sliding when it comes down to predators of children, but certainly in America, that would have happened. Now, during this period of time, one of the things that happened to LaFave is that she and her husband split up. He actually left very quickly after her being charged, their marriage dissolved. And she did say initially she was devastated by the fact that he left, but I think over time she's come to terms with the fact that he was just absolutely blown apart by her unfaithfulness and also by the fact that she was literally a predator around children. She wasn't the person that he believed that she was. And he said in reports and in interviews, he was just blindsided by the case. Now, by 2006, she became basically a cultural symbol. She was invoked in conversations about gender bias in sentencing. She was talked about in the attractiveness factor in media portrayals of crime. And of course, what has also been brought in is that double-edged sword, the way that the justice system needs to protect victims versus public expectations of punishment. Because the punishment should still fit the crime, even when a victim's needs are there. And you don't want dangerous predators wandering the streets, even if it costs the victim in having to give evidence. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that you'll believe that she should have gone to prison or otherwise. I'm just saying that's how the balance should be, that sometimes even when the victim's going to be traumatized, the public interest is at a point where that should happen to protect the rest of us, so to speak. Now, after all of this had happened, 2 years into her probation, she ends up returning to the headlines. And the reason for that is she's accused of violating the conditions of her probation in December 2007. So she gets arrested at this point, but she then was released from jail under a promise to appear in court for a hearing. Now, what happened was her probation conditions said that she was forbidden from any unsupervised contact with minors under 18. But she's lost a job. She can't work as a teacher anymore. She's lost the marriage. So she's not got him to depend on. So she, of course, has to find employment. Finding a job when you're a registered sex offender ain't very good for career choices. You know, a lot of people are going to limit you. But she did manage to become employed as a waitress at a Tampa area restaurant called Danny Boy's. So she ends up working as a receptionist as well. This is at her mother's barbershop. But according to a Department of Corrections report, Deborah ends up discussing her personal life and other subjects with a teenage waitress at the restaurant where they both worked. Now, there's no sexual relationship here. There's nothing that she did that was untoward. It's simply that she talked to an under 18. And bear in mind, she's been told that she can't be near children. Now, it was unlikely she was going to serve any time behind bars for such a minor offence and violation, but they did still need to bring her in for it. And bear in mind, on a technical level, she could have been sentenced to up to 15 years in prison for that violation. Now, she did successfully argue it was just a friendship, it was nothing more, and her attorney said he was really disappointed that her probation officer ordered her arrest for what he called an insignificant violation. He's really on side with her, isn't he? I mean, he's really on side. I mean, I understand why they brought her in. It shows that they were actually looking, that she was acting according to the license that she was given, and that's a good thing. How often do we talk about people not taking those things seriously? So better to be cautious in these cases. But he basically said, look, the conversations between Deborah Lefebvre and the 17-year-old girl was a typical workplace conversation that women have with their women colleagues. And she said they basically talked about non-work related issues such as family problems, friends, high school, personal life, boyfriend issues, and sexual issues. So at this point, Lefebvre was ordered by her probation worker to quit working at the restaurant. And ultimately, the court ruled the violation was not willful and substantial. In other words, she hadn't sought the contact or intentionally broken her probation terms. So because of this, she was cleared and she was allowed to continue serving her probation under supervision. But she did continue to receive constant backlash because a lot of media outlets referred to her as having re-offended. Now, by 2011, Deborah Lefebvre had served 6 years of a 10-year supervision sentence, and her attorneys at this point petitioned the court to end her probation early. They basically said, look, she's done really well. She's abided by the conditions of her sentence. She's maintained employment. She's stayed out of legal trouble. She's remained in psychiatric treatment for bipolar disorder. And so Judge Wayne S. Timmerman did grant her early termination in September 2011, but it didn't last long. In August 2012, Florida's Second District Court of Appeal reinstated her probation. And what the judges wrote was that an early termination was, quote, an abuse of judicial power resulting in a gross miscarriage of justice. So she was then put back onto strict probation once again. So that meant a 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. curfew, no unsupervised contact with children, mandatory counselling and psychiatric treatment, and ongoing restrictions on her employment options. Now, her probation officially ended on October 16, 2014. And I guess that brings us up to the present day, her life now. So since she finished probation, she's committed no new crimes. She does still remain a registered sex offender. She did give birth to twin boys around 2011. She separated from the guy that she had those children to, but she has remarried a new man. And that means that she's now raising a young family. She lives in a modest Tampa suburb, apparently in a 3-bedroom home. And of course, understandably, she's withdrawn from the media spotlight as much as possible. She now works in jobs that avoid interactions with minors, such as restaurants. But of course, despite her efforts to move on, she's still recognised in public all the time for what she did. And a friend of hers named Zuniga said in an interview with a news outlet, she's a completely different person now than when she was 24. She's grown up a lot, she's become a Christian, and she's a great mom. She recently got married and she just ignores the media. She knows it will always be there, but she focuses on her life now. It's very normal. And actually, that same friend self-published a biography titled A Crown of Beauty for Ashes. And that book was created with Deborah's cooperation. So it basically paints a portrait of her spiritual growth and her attempts to rebuild her life after the scandal. But apparently, she does occasionally receive hate mail, which you would expect, because let's remember that whilst the focus very much became on Lefebvre during this period of time, particularly when she committed the offences, there is a victim out there. There is still a victim out there. There is a young man who had his youth blighted by a predatory female teacher who was meant to protect him. And he has to live with that knowledge day in and day out. And I think it's incredibly difficult for young men who end up having sex, particularly with very attractive teachers who should know better and should do better, because they have a conflict. They have all of these guys around them, high-fiving them, telling them how amazing embarrassing they are, telling them how jealous they are of that person, you know, the fact that they're getting to have sex with the teacher. And that means that it suppresses very often the emotional fallout and collateral damage that is done to that young man and his ability to speak about it. Because people are like, well, why are you bothered? I mean, at the end of the day, you got to have sex with a gorgeous older woman. And that is so destructive. And I'm sure that some men who come to this channel and watch this will understand exactly what I'm talking about, because you will have been there yourself and you will know that it creates a wall of silence. And as opposed to it being seen for the scandal it is, it's seen as something you should be proud of. We would never say that to a 14-year-old girl who was raped by her teacher. We would never speak those words. No one would say, oh, I bet you're thrilled that you were taken advantage of by a 23-year-old man who was meant to teach you and protect you. We would never allow those words to fall from our lips. And yet regularly, this is said to young men who end up in these situations. And I want to highlight that because somebody listening will have been there and been through it, and this will resonate, and it was not your fault. You did nothing wrong and you did not deserve that violation. And it was, is, and will always be a violation of the highest order. It is the worst thing an adult can do with a child. It betrays that child on every single level, and it causes fractures that can at times never be healed. What do you think of this case? Do you guys believe she got the right sentence? When you look at her, are you conflicted because of the way that she appears? She looks so nice. And if you look so nice, how can you ever really do anything that diabolical?
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.